Hello, listeners, and welcome to Sportspiel, the podcast that always backs up its files. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, as ever, to discuss all things sport, is Mr. Will Moulton.
Are you in a slightly better mood than when you put that video out last week?
A little bit. If people paid attention to our social media pages and were expecting a full episode last week, IT difficulties happened in that half of the episode. So basically, everything we recorded last week got wiped.
But it was fine because Lainey's interview was really good, so it didn't really matter in
exactly.
The end.
So we're back a week after to bring you episode 25, the reboot. And also three days afterwards, my computer died. It was killed. So we're on a new computer now and everything. So put two and two together and maybe you can understand why the audio got wiped. On the discussion section today, at least it will be until it gets wiped, we have got two topics lined up. Firstly, with the 2018 World Cup set to come to an end this weekend, we will pick five things each that we have learnt from the tournament, although some of those things may be the same thing, so there will be less than 10. But hey. After that, we will then talk Wimbledon, which is another tournament that's drawing to a close this weekend, and we will ask, is it too old-fashioned? Our feature interview guest on today's show is European gold medalist and Olympic bronze medalist Emily Diamond. We chat about her life in sport, managing the highs and the lows, as well as inspiring the younger generation through sport. All that and more on this episode of Sportspiel. The unpredictability, the joy, the pain. This year's FIFA World Cup has been a wild ride. Much like a theme park roller coaster, you were coaxed in because you thought it would be fun. And it was. There were unpredictable loops, high intensity speed, and a thrill you don't get to experience too often. But then you want more, and you keep going back, until you overdo it on the roller coaster, and yes, you throw up at the end. Well, Wednesday night was the vomiting stage, as England went out in the semi-finals to Croatia, meaning that the trophy would not be coming home. But it was fun while it lasted. But anyway, the tournament as a whole has taught us a lot, from Putin's appearances to FIFA President Gianni Infantino's attempt to be a man of the people as he turned up dressed in the volunteer's kit at a press conference. That's one well-paid volunteer, by the way. But we will ask, what have we, the people, and two presenters of a podcast, what have we learnt from the FIFA World Cup in Russia? So we have some pointers here and there. I suppose we'll go through, as we normally do, our list and what we've written down.
Well, I've just thought of one that I hadn't written down, but it is
a bonus point.
Gianni Infantino's eyebrows are just incredible.
Well, he's got the makeup for the loss of hair.
All
on
that
his
needs
head.
To be said.
We'll leave it at that.
I'll start and I'll stick with Russia, as you've mentioned there. And I think the main thing we've learned is that Russia isn't actually all bad, and there's quite a lot of good bits to it.
Quite coincidentally, we prepared for this independently. We didn't talk about it, and we arrived with the exact same sentence written down, and Russia isn't all that bad.
Yeah, it's done all right. Some lovely stadiums. The fans have all been passionate. Seems like everyone who's been out there has had a really good time, good experience. There's no hooligans. There's been no, well, from what we've seen, no homophobia, no racism. They've hosted what has come across as a pretty good tournament and completely put all the worries to bed. So
yeah, I think from the journalists and reporters who are out there, I think the overriding message is no matter how bad the political regime may be, whatever your opinion of that is, it doesn't spoil what is essentially quite a beautiful country. And it also doesn't spoil people who are predominantly quite nice and friendly.
I mean, one of my dad's best mate's wife is Russian, and she's always said that it's such a lovely country, and that the way it's reported is unfair in the media. And to be honest, the likelihood is they deliberately put on a good show to try and make themselves look good for political points. But to be honest, that I don't really mind that, as long as they don't go and do something outrageous off the back of it.
Exactly, but it's all been good and it's all been positive. But the overriding issues with the country do still remain. I think predominantly from a media point of view, it's maybe very focused on Moscow. and Moscow being this the representation of Russia, and that's not exactly true. And maybe that's the big thing we've learned.
It's also just nice to see a World Cup being hosted properly, potentially for the last time ever.
Bring on 2022.
And then 2026, that's being held in however many countries it is.
Yes. Moving on to my first point, which I think is another point that you have, and it's just general England under Gareth Southgate and England at this tournament. Because as disappointing as the ending was in the semi-finals, although we do still have a third place playoff to look forward to as we record, it will have happened by the time this goes out. But it was, considering I wasn't born, you weren't born, the last time England were in a World Cup semi-final in 1990, it just makes such a nice change for everyone to be happy about it for once, rather than just overriding disappointment.
We all came in with such low expectations. I think everyone was thinking quarterfinals at best. And it's not been perfect. You know, the team, if you think about it, haven't played that well, probably more often than they have played really well. But when they have played really well, it's been brilliant and electrifying. And it's just been so fresh. The whole approach to this tournament has just been so modern, so up-to-date, whereas under previous regimes, previous managers, it's been so outdated and very us versus them in terms of the fans and the media versus the players. And this has just been a completely fresh start, and hopefully it's just the beginning. You know, 2 years' time in the Euros, this squad could go really far. 4 years' time, the likelihood is there'll be the same bunch of players. So it's an exciting time, and let's just hope it keeps progressing upwards.
That is one of the big things, is we hope it is just the beginning. And when you look at it, it's a very young team overall. I know you've got your Ashley Youngs and your Fabian Delphs, etc. But also, if you look at the under-21 setup now, there are a few players coming through that and through some of the other England youth teams that could rise up and fit perfectly well into that system that Gareth Southgate's got going.
As we discussed on the podcast last year, when the youth teams were winning every tournament they were playing, we've got some brilliant footballers in this country. We just now need to convince the Premier League and the Premier League managers that they need to play. Whether we can do that or whether they can do that or not is another question, but hopefully there's going to be managers like Sean Dyche and Eddie Howe who are willing to take a punt on young English players. Hopefully, you know, if the likes of Unai Emery and Jurgen Klopp aren't going to bring them through, then get them to the Bournemouths and the Burnleys and other teams that are coming up and play them there, get them Premier League experience against the biggest names, and that will only help our nation. But we actually have to do that.
Exactly.
We can't just sit here talking about it.
Although I'm also excited to see the potential of, say, Pep Guardiola and what he would do with someone like Phil Foden, who's very highly touted. And from what we hear, he is a big fan of him and what he can do, and he's still, what, 17?
Well, Guardiola's actually taken me by surprise this season, because in his first year at City, he barely played any English players ever. And then this year, he regularly had three or four in the team at all times, plus he had Foden on the bench. So perhaps he is recognising that English talent is there and, you know, he's going to make his team successful. And let's hope Foden becomes the player he's destined to be under Guardiola.
Yeah. And one other player I will put a shout out for, who I'm very excited to see how he gets on this season, is Ryan Sessegnon at Fulham. Because Massively. Fulham's just been promoted into the Premier League this year. So it'll be his first taste of Premier League football, if he stays, of course. But think of the position that Ashley Young plays in for England now. Isn't that just tailor-made for someone like Ryan Sessegnon to come through?
Well, he's arguably a better fit for that position than Young is, in some ways. I thought Young had a good tournament, but he hasn't got a left foot, and he's not going to be around forever. So we haven't got that many left-sided wingers at the moment in this country. The ones that we thought were coming through haven't quite progressed as they should have done. But then you've got Sessegnon, who can defend, can attack, scores goals for fun, scores with both feet. A really, really exciting prospect. Could have quite easily gone to this tournament. Imagine him on one side and Alexander-Arnold on the other. It'd be epic.
That could be the
Although
case.
Although Trippier was brilliant in Russia.
Yeah, but give it 2-4 years' time and we'll see what's happened. One last mention for the England team as well is mainly the dignity and the way they conduct themselves. A lot of that comes from Gareth Southgate, but I thought the players are just probably the most likeable England team I can remember. Because, yes, we had some stars in the past, but there was still touches of ego here and there. And for people who don't regularly watch the England team now and only really turned on for the World Cup, that's predominantly what the message has been. They just seem like a really nice bunch.
Well, that's what Lampard and Gerrard have both alluded to before. And they're both very likable guys, and they always came across fairly well. But they alluded to, you know, the egos and the discord in the team and everything like that. And also Southgate is just man-managed brilliantly. And he's also, to misquote Matt Smith's Doctor Who, taught us that waistcoats are cool.
Waistcoats are cool.
Waistcoats are cool.
Moving on, and one of my other points is Croatia, which kind of comes into something you're saying, I think. Because throughout the disappointment of us going out in the semi-final, we've kind of missed the point about how incredible it is that a country with just a population of around 4.5 million people has made it to a World Cup final. Think of how crazy they're going back home, knowing that their team has gotten to the first World Cup final in their history.
It's incredible, but it does beg the question, you know, how have they got there? Because if you look at their team, well, you've got two properly world-class players in Rakitic and Modric, and that's it. So that was going to...
Oh, that's a bit harsh, I think.
As in you'd have them in any team. Who else in that team would you handpick to be in your team?
I think Mandzukic, he's not necessarily in his prime years now, but when he was at his best, I thought he was one of the best strikers around. And I think I would have... Yes, maybe in terms of talent, but in terms of being a workhorse matched with talent, I think even Perisic is a pretty decent left winger to have as well.
Yeah, they're both good players, but there's a reason why... I mean, yes, Mandzukic has played for a couple of big teams, but there's a reason why that they've never been picked up by the likes of Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United in their pomp, in my opinion.
But Mandzukic was at Bayern and did very well
at Bayern. And he is at Juventus.
And he's still doing very well at Juventus.
But they're not quite... the level of,
but then you look at Spanish that, look teams. At that midfield as well, and they are blessed in central midfield with Modric and Rakitic, but also Brozovic at Inter Milan, Kovacic at Real Madrid, who can't get into the Croatian starting 11, but he will probably get
into
most.
Ante Rebic, who I thought has played really well this tournament.
Rebic has been very good. Milan Badelj as well, who's at Fiorentina, I think, is also quite a solid holding midfielder as well. And let's not forget Dejan Lovren.
You look at the defence, and I think Domagoj Vida has been one of the players of the tournament. We'll forget his political actions, to put them to one side, and his questionable haircut and his unfortunate ears. He's been brilliant at centre-back throughout the entire tournament. He's made Dejan Lovren look good. And then you've got Sime Vasalko alongside him as well, at right-back, who's been unbelievable.
And also Subasic, the goalkeeper, who plays for Monaco.
So, yeah, I mean, my point with Croatia was that experience has been key. So these are players who've been there, who've done that. You know, they're maybe slightly later on in their careers, but they've had all that nous, all that knowledge, and they've put that into this tournament. They've had to come through three extra times in the knockout stages. They've got through each and every one of them. Modric's messages after the England game were actually really telling about how they... saw the perceived arrogance of the English media and used that to their advantage. And you know, that was a little bit of naivety on our side, but also them. They've been there before. Modric has been part of teams that have been written off, Real Madrid teams and Spurs teams, and they've used that and put that all that experience in, and that's why they've come through to the final. And I think they deserve to be there. I think they played really well in the group stages, not played so well in the knockout stages, but they've shown so much tenacity, nous, and intelligence to get through to the final, and you know, you wish them all the best.
And I think a lot of that reaction from the English media probably comes from a section that doesn't actually watch all that much football, and just goes on your traditional big name countries in terms of international football, of which Croatia is not. But then you look at that team, and it is one of the best teams on paper.
It's like in my opinion, you've got those two world class players surrounded by a bunch of very talented team-based players with a massive team ethos, and that's what's really helped them through, is that they've played as a team, they've done everything as a team.
Think Portugal at the Euros.
Yeah.
One world-class player and a bunch of talented players.
If you look at Argentina, the team they thrashed in the group stage is a bunch of individuals up front with no team behind them, and they were truly awful.
Prime example. Moving on now to something, again, we both have, which we alluded to in last week's mythical episode, sexism. Because there's one thing that this tournament has taught us, is that sexism, particularly to female broadcasters and female reporters in the media, is still very much there.
Especially in this country.
but especially in this country, and also from behaviour of certain fans out there in Russia as well.
Yeah, but yeah, I think the reaction to Ennio Luco and Alex Scott when they were in the first week when they were broadcasting was just, I thought was really, really unfair. So many people were criticising them. And the comments that were really getting me were, I'm sorry, you can't have women's players talking about the men's football because, you know, it's a completely different game. I'm like, what? Like, these are two of the best players we've had, male or female, in a generation. They've represented their country numerous times. There's a reason why they've done so. They're brilliant footballers. They're intelligent footballers. And there's also a reason why, you know, this is Ennio Luco's third major tournament that she's covered. There is a reason why Alex Scott is already a regular on BBC. And there's a reason why Vicky Sparks was chosen as a commentator to become the first woman to live commentate on a men's World Cup match. And that's because they're insightful, they're passionate, they're knowledgeable, and they've got brilliant personalities, and they're bloody good at their jobs.
Like, they work hard and they're good at it.
It doesn't matter what gender they are.
Exactly.
It's just frustrating that there are so many Neanderthalic people out there with these stupid 19th, 18th medieval century views. It's just, it's annoying. But they've, credit to them, as I've alluded to in the 52 this week, the professionalism they've shown just to override it all, you know, hold the moral high ground and just get on with their jobs has been superb. And I look forward to seeing a lot more of them on our screens in the future.
And then you look at, I suppose, the flashpoint in this country was when Jason Cundy went on and had a debate with Lindsay Hooper, no relation, about, it was after Vicky Sparks did the commentary, and it was about whether you would like a woman to be a commentator or not. And he said that women's voices were too high-pitched for him to enjoy the commentary, and that's why they shouldn't be doing it.
Well, he was then forced into the most grovelling apology.
He apologised in several tweets later that evening for everything he said and taking it all back, basically. But that highlighted to me, again, the dinosaur attitudes that very much still exist in our game.
It's fine not to like a commentator because you don't like the sound of their voice.
But to blanket all women under the same thing...
is wrong.
Is my issue.
Is ridiculous. So for... there are plenty of male commentators I'm sure both of us aren't keen on, and there's probably one or two female commentators that we're also not keen on, but there's also plenty of male and female commentators that we like. One of my favourite co-commentators is actually Sue Smith, who does a lot of the England women's games on the BBC. Like, and she's got a brilliant voice, like this really thick Northern Yorkshire voice, but it just works. And some people like her, some people don't like her. It's just a matter of opinion. But to say that all women's voices are rubbish is horrible and wrong.
Exactly.
That's all I have to say.
And quite rightly said. My final point is something that popped into my head when I was writing the piece that I did for the Offside Rule after the England-Sweden game, and it was to do with social media, which we have talked about a bit on this podcast. In fact, one of our mental health specials with Shona McAllen was predominantly about social media and the impact it can have. But I asked the question, is actually being involved in social media through a... big tournament, is it actually that bad? Because a lot of tournament teams in other sports are probably advised to stay off the social media and detract yourself from that pressure, that online pressure. But our England team at this World Cup were on social media pretty much the entire time, but having some fun with it and telling jokes and offering to pay for a fan's tattoo of John Stones when John Stones scored that double against Panama. So I picked up on that and I said, actually, is that a little bit of a Gareth Southgate piece of magic? Because if you're going through a Premier League season, you'd be on the social media all the time. So is it actually treating international duty and a big tournament very much like you would as a domestic campaign? And does that calm everyone right down?
I think it would have certainly been a team decision, and they would have spent a lot of time discussing how they were going to use it. And ultimately they came to the decision that what they did worked best for them. They were just going to have some fun. They probably didn't take any notice of any of the hate. They probably didn't read any comments or anything like that. But it's interesting from my perspective. So Team GB girls hockey team, women's hockey team at Rio came off social media because they didn't want it to be a distraction or anything like that. And they went and won gold. And then the England men's team stayed on social media. And interestingly enough, both teams had the same, well, one of the same sort of psychologists with them, Dr. Ben Rosenblatt, And he was behind, largely behind decisions on both sides. So it's just interesting to see how thing, how like, it's just different approaches for different people and what works for you. These guys clearly sat down, worked out what they wanted to do, what worked best for them, and it worked. And
find,
it did
find
well.
The policy and stick to it.
Yeah, just be, and just be consistent with it. Don't, you know, chop and change throughout the tournament, which they didn't.
Exactly. Do you have any final points before we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, just that the world rankings are a little bit of a joke. We came into this tournament, Russia were ranked, what, 64th in the world, but they haven't really played any competitive fixtures because they didn't have to qualify, so that's obviously affected their rankings. And we came in with Poland ranked something like 6th in the world because they haven't played any friendlies in 18 months in order to increase their world rankings. And I just think it shows that, should the tournament draw be based on world rankings, because in terms of the way the pools are split, because if you look at some groups, they were really, really tough groups, and if you look at other groups, it was really, really easy for some teams. It's just highlights the fact that world rankings aren't the be-all and end-all of everything. You know, we've got Croatia in the final, who aren't probably the highest ranked team in the world, but they have shown, like we said, so much experience, so much nous to get through to the final. And then we've got, you know, the likes of Brazil and Argentina, some of the highest ranked teams in the world.
Germany,
just being
rubbish. Number one, I think, going into
it. Yeah, just being rubbish and flopping. So world rankings count for nothing, and they should either be changed or scrapped.
On to topic two now. And as we do every year, we have been treated to a little bit of a trip down memory lane over at SW19. Amongst the stunning displays of tennis we see, there is always something deeply historic about the Wimbledon tournament, right from the arena, the setting, all the way down to the all-white kit. But we're asking today, should it, and maybe tennis more as a whole, should it actually move with the times and modernise? The first point we're going to touch on with regards to modernisation is the unlimited final set in tennis. Because this is off the back of Kevin Anderson and John Isner having, was it the second longest game
in Grand Slam history.
And that was their semi-final.
Semi-final a lot. Yeah. So last night, so we're recording Saturday morning, so that went on for 6 hours on Friday and subsequently meant that Nadal versus Djokovic in the other semi-final is having to be restarted this morning because they reached the 11 o'clock cut-off time in the evening. And it was just interesting that both players after the game came out and said, you know, we would have been happy if at 12 all in the fifth and final set, so double what they would normally play, we went to a tie break then. And John McEnroe said it. It's just very interesting that, you know, they all, so many people are coming out and saying that. And it's right, because obviously we love the long fifth sets, but if we think back to 2010, John Isner again against Nicolas Mahut, the final set was 70-68, and it just gets beyond the point of being fun.
Flip side of this, it doesn't happen that often in terms of having matches that long, but when it does, thinking the John Isner and Nicolas Mahut thing, it became a spectacle in itself.
But it became,
and I thought it was hugely entertaining.
It became really boring to watch because they were just big serves and that was it. They couldn't hold a rally.
But in terms of the spectacle, it was, at some point, someone's got to make a mistake. And that's what captivated me.
But it's also incredibly unfair then on the winner who goes through, because they're going to be absolutely knackered. I mean, in this case, admittedly, because Nadal Djokovic has gone over into today, it would probably be negated. But Mahut, that game went on for 3 days. He came out the winner and then was thrashed in straight sets the next day because he was just so tired. It's unfair on the player that wins, effectively.
I actually quite like it myself. I can see an argument against it from a scheduling perspective and perhaps the exhaustion side as well, but then just be better. Just be a better player.
That's a good point. I think it's also something needs to happen with the serves as well, because John Isner and Kevin Anderson both have huge first serves and little else is there. You know, I think we need to... We want to watch tennis for skills of all sorts on display, and that was what was so good about Nadal versus Djokovic the first three sets last night. Was there were some big serves, there's some great baseline play, but there's also some really cute strokes, and anyone who's watched Federer knows that he can just do anything and everything. I think there needs to be something in tennis which takes away the advantage of the big first servers a little bit, because, you know, that's where most of these games go on for so long, is because of these big first serves. And there's got to be something, a new rule or technology or something brought in just to slightly eliminate the advantage they're given, because it shouldn't all be about having a massive first serve.
I'm not sure it is. I actually quite like the fact that you have these varied players who with different strengths. You talk about Kevin Anderson and John Isner, their big serve is their strength. But then I like the fact that whoever is coming up against them, be it a Nadal or a Djokovic or a Federer, has to alter their game and change it in a way that they can adapt to that. And that makes them the great tennis players that they are, because ultimately that's what they've been doing for the entirety of their careers. Granted, Federer got knocked out this year by Kevin Anderson and he couldn't deal with the serve, but in years gone by, he and they are the greatest players that we've seen for God knows how long, because they know how to adapt better.
But there is also the fact that these players, those players are of a certain age, and the young players coming through now are not being able to break through against some of the big servers or against some of these better players. And it's just, you know, is there something behind that in terms of the service or something like that? Don't know. It's difficult to tell.
They need to adapt better in the way that Djokovic, Nadal and Federer have. And Andy Murray to an extent
as well.
I also just
like seeing long rallies, to be honest.
I can see where you're going from it, because you're going from a spectator's standpoint and a spectator's point of view, whereas I'm going and approaching it from adapt your game and be a better player and stop moaning about the strengths that someone else has got. Use your own strengths is how I see it.
New balls, please.
Moving on then to another point, and that's the women's game. And we're sticking with the sets aspect as well, because women still play 3 sets, whereas men play 5 sets at Grand Slams. Should that be changed in that women also play 5 sets, considering they are given equal prize money now, and while it's often debated, still have probably one of the most equal platforms in a lot of sports?
Well, I think if everything else is going to be equal, then the number of sets they play should be equal as well.
We agree.
When you put it like that, sounds really simple and stupid that they haven't changed it.
But a lot of them want it to be changed as well. A lot of them say, well, we can deal with a 5-setter.
Some of the men don't want to play 5 sets. I think I love 5-setters at slams. Federer versus Anderson, what a game that was. What a comeback that was from Kevin Anderson. Like, you can't get that same level of excitement and drama and intrigue in a 3-setter. That's just why I think, potentially why not always the women's game is treated by fans the same as the men's, because you don't get so many of these incredible comeback stories. And I think if the women are happy with it, then let's just make them play 5 sets.
Well, we agree on that point. Moving on. Do we need line judges? Question.
It's interesting.
What with Hawkeye and all that? Do they serve a purpose?
So we're having this debate about tennis being behind the times, but in so many ways, tennis is also one of the forerunners in terms of technology. Hawkeye's been involved for a long, long time in tennis. You know, the technology that goes into the rackets and the surface and everything is unbelievable. And it's just strange to think that we still have line judges when we can have technology which completely rules out the chance of incorrect decisions, full stop.
I suppose they still serve a purpose in that the immediacy of their decisions is what they're there for. Granted, they don't get them all right, but they do get a vast majority of them right, and it just helps speed along the play rather than waiting for the Hawkeye every so often.
I mean, I like having line judges there, because it's like the same in any sport. The umpires and the referees and the judges and whatever they are in whatever sport are going to be human. There's going to be the odd mistake made, and it actually gives us something to talk about. And if they've got the technology there to aid them, then that's fine. I think it is fine as it is at the moment. I just know that there's the question being asked of, should we have more technology? Actually, I think tennis has pretty much got it right.
Yeah, I think it's got a perfect balance, where you've got your 3 challenges per set, and then whenever they choose to use it, it becomes a little bit of an event, and everyone claps when the video.
I just wish their uniforms weren't so awful.
Which is another debate in itself. So, onto the uniforms, the all-white kit. Because people complain about it. I think Federer is someone who's complained about it in the past, and the strict rules they have regarding white kit. But we were talking about it earlier, and we actually quite like the fact that they keep that year after year after year at Wimbledon.
I think that's one of the reasons why I actually enjoy watching Wimbledon more than I do any other slams. One of the reasons is I prefer grass court because of the speed of play and everything. I just think it's better. But also, it just looks so much neater if it's all white rather than the pinks and the blues and the greens and whatever colours.
Exactly.
I just think it looks neater and more professional.
There's nothing wrong with a little bit of throwback, I think. And to be honest, there are bigger issues than what kit someone is wearing on that particular day.
And that's a tradition that most of us love and most of us want to keep going.
Exactly. So the overriding message is it's all white on the night. And with that, we will finish up this discussion section because it is feature interview time again. This week's guest is Emily Diamond, 400-metre runner. She has a European gold medal as part of the 4x400 in 2016 to her name. She has a Rio bronze medal, 4x400 again, and she was also part of that silver medal winning quartet at the World Athletics Championships back in 2017. So there's plenty of success there. But as you'll hear from her, there's also plenty of low points that she's had to deal with in her life and had to be mentally strong. So we talk a lot about that, a lot about how she got into the sport as well, and also the task she set herself about inspiring some of the younger generation and keeping them in sport. So stick around for that after this.
Have you signed up to Banana Crumble, the free online cash prize giveaway? Sign up today at www.bananacrumble.co.uk for your chance to win. Sign up is quick, free and easy. Don't believe us? Hear what some of our winners have had to say.
Winning £50 with Banana Crumble was an amazing feeling. Being a student, it's often hard to get money, so I was able to put it straight towards my rent for second term.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Working alongside the Cystic Fibrosis Trust to raise vital funds for this fantastic cause.
Welcome back, everyone, to another feature interview section, and it is that time to launch off the starting blocks and get to know another athlete. And that pun is entirely intentional because our guest today is European gold medalist and Olympic bronze medalist Emily Diamond. Welcome to the show, Emily. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
All good. So now we're here in July 2018, and you look at your name and there's obviously plenty of medals, plenty of success and all that, but as we often do on this podcast, we like to delve into an athlete's journey. Interestingly for you, it could so easily have been a tennis journey. So I'll start off by asking, why did you turn away from the tennis court and start to focus more on the athletic side of things?
Playing when I was about four, and I then sort of got older and went through school and that sort of stuff, started to take it up more seriously, and I was playing so many hours a week and before school when I was sort of in primary school, and I think by the time I'd got to about 15, 16, I'd just had enough of it and just stopped enjoying it and didn't really want to go to my training sessions and things like that, so I wanted to do something a bit different, and athletics was a sort of obvious choice for me, partly because of sort of family history and the sport, and I'd shown a bit of natural talent sort of on the athletic scene sort of while at school, so when I decided I didn't want to do tennis, sort of not doing anything wasn't an option, and that's sort of when I wanted to do athletics instead.
And there's obviously a lot of sporting pedigree in your family as well, because your mum was a long jumper, your grandmother competed at the 1950 European Athletics, I think long jumping again, and your grandfather was a sprinter. So was it almost inevitable that you'd be sporty in one way or another?
Yeah, I think so. Growing up, sort of, sport was always a massive part of our family. My brother was really keen on his sport, and too, my dad was a swimmer when he was younger, so I sort of grew up with sport being a very natural part of life and part of childhood, and I think, I mean, my parents were never pushy in that sense, but me and my brother, sort of especially, we just loved taking part in sport and just did as much as we could, and I think because it's sort of been ingrained in my life from such a young age, sort of stopping it completely when I sort of didn't want to do tennis anymore was just never an option. I would always, if I wasn't going to do tennis, it would be, right, what am I going to do instead, kind of thing. So yeah, and I think I sort of had, I remember a conversation with my mum and sort of thought, I think I'd quite like to give athletics a go. It's been fun doing school competitions, and I would do the occasional one for my local club, and sort of decided that I wanted to try and take that up a bit more seriously.
Does that effectively sum up their influence then on you, in that it wasn't particularly pushy, but it was sort of the right amount of motivation you needed at that exact moment?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my parents were amazing and would drive me, sort of, and my brother, all around the country to competitions at the weekend and training in the week, and my dad would take me to tennis training before school, and things like that. So they were extremely supportive in that sense, but again, would have been very supportive if I had turned around to them and said, actually, I don't want to do this anymore, I'm not keen on sport. But I think sort of they knew that that was never going to happen, because I would just love it too much.
Say they didn't really put pressure on you, but did you put any pressure on yourself, knowing that, you know, your family had reached these high competitive levels before? Was there ever a part of you that said, I want to reach that same sort of level?
In a way, yes. I mean, I knew, I'd obviously seen my mum and my nan's GB kit and their medals in the past, but I sort of knew that I wanted to get the GB kit myself and medals myself, but I sort of never really thought, oh my goodness, they're going to be so disappointed if I don't manage it. That sort of never really crossed my head, and I think it just sort of spurred me on to try and sort of be successful myself as well.
Mm-hmm. So coming on to the 400 metres, because you were predominantly, I suppose, a 200 metre runner during 2010 and 2011.
Yeah.
But prior to the 2012 London Olympics, you were roped into the 4x400 and ended up qualifying for the team. So what was it about the 400 metres that just clicked for you?
Well, I think when I was with my coach, Jared Deacon, at Lough University, we'd sort of sat down and planned a sort of gradual transition from the 200 to the 400, and sort of that would take several years, and I wouldn't just be a 200 metre one year and a 400 metre the next year sort of thing. So becoming a 400 runner was always in the plan. It was just the World Student Games in 2011 that sort of sped up that plan a bit, because I just sort of found myself in the 4x4 team, sort of having never done something before, never done a 400 before. So it was a little bit by chance, but I think I would have become a 400 metre runner anyway if I hadn't been sort of found in that situation. It just would have occurred a little bit later.
Other than the obvious difference, I suppose, in distance, what is the difference from an athlete's perspective in running 400 metres to 200 metres? How do you approach a race differently?
Well, I mean, the tactics are very different. 200s, obviously, it's much more of a flat-out sprint the whole way than 400 is. You've got to pace yourself much more on the 4 and sort of prepare for the inevitable pain that you're going to get down the home straight. So I think for me personally, I mean, I sort of can't really speak for other athletes, but for me personally, the 400 is much more sort of mentally challenging than the 200. But I do miss running the 200, so I sort of would quite like to do a few more of those if I can. But the season just tends to run away from you, so it's quite tricky to sort of fit everything in. But yeah, the 400 is certainly quite a challenge.
And you say mentally challenging. What kind of things do you mean? Is it sort of getting halfway round and realising you still have another 200 metres to go, kind of thing?
Yeah, and I think sort of for me, coming from a 200 background initially, I'd sort of get to the 200 mark where I'd normally be finishing and think, oh my goodness, I'm only halfway, I've got to go for another 200 metres. And I think as well, like, at the start of the 400, you've got to go out hard to set yourself up for the race. But when you know you're going to struggle in the home straight, it's so, and you sort of subconsciously you want to save energy, so it's sort of almost feeling like you're having to do the opposite and to go out hard at the start when you know you're going to be wanting to save energy is sort of difficult, because you're almost going against what you feel your instincts are.
And before we touch on sort of the medals and things, because I imagine 2016 was effectively the year that you would call your breakout year, if there was one.
I
just want to discuss taking things to the next level, because as an athlete and a sprinter, how difficult is it to actually keep pushing and trying to better yourself?
That's really difficult, and I think that's what I've sort of discovered in the last couple of years, that it's so easy to have a great year and think, right, this is fantastic, now my next year is going to be even better, and okay, I've run this time this year, and next year I'm going to run half a second quicker. I think it's so easy to get carried away, and sometimes you have to sort of take a step back and give yourself a bit of credit for what you've done. And although everyone obviously has got aspirations to improve on that, and there's no reason why you can't, but it's so difficult to come back from a fantastic year and have an even more fantastic year. And if that sort of doesn't happen, it's just a case of making sure that you're not too hard on yourself and you're not too sort of negative, because everyone's going to have a best year in their life, because that's their best year sort of thing. So it's just a case of trying to maintain what you can and trying to keep your sort of motivation up, and hope that you can sort of keep progressing as the years go by.
Was that one of the biggest hurdles for you then, is being able to take a step back and not being too hard on yourself when things didn't go to plan?
Yeah, definitely. I think the start of 2017, I sort of almost expected it to kick off as I ended 2016, and when that didn't happen, I would sort of get into panic mode and try and work out why it wasn't happening. And so realistically, everyone's got to start a season somewhere, and as an athlete, trying not to panic and trying not to overthink things is a very difficult thing. I think sort of several athletes will probably agree with me in the sense that it's so easy to overthink training and races, and really you've just got to go with the flow and believe in your process and believe in your training and your coach and all that sort of stuff, and just know that it will come at some point. It's just a matter of when.
In terms of mental strength then, were you always a mentally strong character, or was there a moment or someone out there that kind of gave you that spark, that kind of key to actually cracking mental resilience?
I think I've always been really good at being able to push myself in training, and I've always been really determined and sort of want to do well, but I've also been very hard on myself and sort of my biggest critic, and struggled with sort of self-confidence in the past and belief in my own ability. So I certainly haven't had the greatest sort of mental ability inside of training, but in sort of 2016 I sort of started working with a psychologist, a guy called Paul Hull, who I used to work with at Prior Park College, and he sort of sat down with me and got me sort of thinking the right on the right sort of lines and sort of preparing me for my sort of preparation for the Olympics, and that made such a big difference in sort of believing in myself and sort of not overthinking things, not being too negative and harsh. And I think that's sort of really important, to not easily sort of get into that negative cycle.
Exactly. And I'm so interested, I think you mentioned this in a piece in Athletics Weekly, and it was something I don't think too often about, and probably a few others don't think is that important, but it's the financial aspect as well of actually being an athlete, because you mentioned that it was so hard to find employers that were willing to give people work if they're actually trying to have a successful athletics career as well. So I wonder, how much does that financial burden or worry play into things as well?
That can have a massive impact on sort of athletes, because I think sort of everyone sort of worries at some point or another about paying bills and what you're going to do to survive. And in athletics, it's very much the athletes can often only get paid if you're performing well. So if you're having a year when you're injured and you're not on funding, and therefore you can't race because you're injured, then you can have a year where you earn sort of next to nothing, and that can be so difficult. So I sort of tried to find myself a part-time job, because I didn't particularly want to be training, working 9 to 5, and then having to go straight to the track to do a sort of horrendous 400 metre session after a full day's work. So I found myself a part-time job to sort of help fund my athletics, because at the time I wasn't on funding. So, and they were fantastic, really, in sort of allowing me to have days off if I needed to travel to competitions or the day before trials, for example. They said I didn't sort of have to come in and work because they wanted me to prepare for trials, and it's so nice and it's so helpful when you can find an employer who understands sort of the needs of an athlete and what an athlete is going through. But because of sort of our season in the summer, it works quite well with schools because that's generally like the school holidays. So there'll only be like a sort of small overlap of working and competitions and things like that. But it can be a really big struggle for athletes. And if you've got something on the sort of back of your mind that you're worrying about, you don't want to sort of start having that affecting your training and competition, because then again, you can get into a bit of a negative cycle and it sort of can be really tricky to get out of.
Exactly, yeah. Trying to stay positive throughout all of that, effectively. So now we come on to 2016 and the medals, if you like, because there was a European gold medal in the 4x400, then the Olympic bronze in the 4x400 as well. Is that a gradual progression of all the work that you put in the years previously, or was there again a moment where it's just everything fell into place, both physically and mentally?
Working hard for sort of many years leading up to 2016. 2015, the year before, I was pretty much injured for the whole year with a hamstring tear. So I sort of went from almost having no season at all to essentially the best season of my career. But I think probably because of my frustrating year in 2015, it sort of spurred me on even more to have a successful one in 2016, and it was just fantastic that it happened to be an Olympic year as well. And then sort of I changed my coach, so I went back to Jared Deakin for 2016 and was in a different situation because I was training in Bath and he was living up in Scotland. So there were sort of new hurdles that we were trying to overcome and to try and sort of work around. But I think it was just a case of I was in a much happier place in myself and things were going really well. I was enjoying my training again, and because of that I was competing well, and because I was competing well, I was excited and in a better place. And then it's almost like a positive cycle. Everything's just going from great to great, really.
Exactly. Is that arguably your career highlight then, or is there something else that you consider to be on a par or even higher?
I think obviously the Olympics is the pinnacle of our sport, so getting an Olympic medal is definitely one of my sort of top two performances. But I think as well, with being sort of a European champion a few months before, that was my first time running in an international final, and being on the top of a podium is a fantastic experience. And then sort of the year after as well with the London World Championships and getting a silver medal there in front of a home crowd was just again a fantastic and slightly surreal experience. And it's difficult to compare them all because they're both different in their own right. But yeah, I would certainly say sort of getting an Olympic medal in 2016 is certainly up there.
Mm-hmm. Also, this aspect between individual racing and racing as part of a team or in a relay team, is it almost nicer that your medal successes, you get to share it with teammates on the podium?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I love the sort of personnel of the relays. 4x4s is such a great event, and it's so nice being with the sort of three or plus the sort of two extras that you'll have in the heat, that you're sort of all part of the team together and you're all warming up together, and you win as a team and you lose as a team if things don't go quite to plan. And it's just such a nice atmosphere, and although there obviously is still pressure, it seems sort of slightly more relaxed maybe than an individual. So I sort of personally really enjoy doing the relays.
So looking at this year, 2018, and obviously we've had the Commonwealth Games earlier in the year, how do you assess what's happened to you this year in terms of performance?
It's been a difficult one. It's been different with having a major champ so early on in the year and sort of almost starting a season, if you like, with the championships. It's definitely a different experience, partly as well because we're having to do race prep stuff in sort of February, which I haven't sort of particularly done before because I don't tend to do indoors. So from Commonwealth Games, sort of happy but sort of again wanting more, and I only just missed out on the final there and finishing ninth, and then we finished fourth in the relay, so not almost the sort of two worst places to finish. So I came back sort of just happy but wanting more and wanting to sort of progress my season for the European Championships, and for whatever reason I've had a sort of few frustrating races and I don't feel like it's, my races are really quite clicked yet, but training stuff's been going well, and again it's trying to listen to my own advice and staying positive and know I've got a good time in there. Sort of, it's in me, it's just a case of which race is it gonna come out for.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I've heard from a few athletes, I suppose, is that because of the early timing of the Commonwealth Games this year, has that kind of thrown a little your timetable out of kilter a little bit, in that, I suppose, do you usually build up to the end of the year for things like that?
Yeah, I mean, because I don't do the indoor season, so I would normally be still doing all my like longer winter sessions in sort of February, March, whereas this year that I was having to sort of get ready and to race stuff for the Commonwealth Games. So I could say that I missed a few winter sort of months when I was prepping for the Commonwealth Games, but I sort of don't think that would have a massive effect on my season now in the sort of European season, if you like. I think it's just a case of sort of trying to mentally get yourself ready for another championships and trials and things like that, and sort of prepare yourself for another major championships. And it's like, again, it's the times are there. It's just putting it all together and getting it all sort of to work perfectly in a race.
Yeah, and in terms of preparing yourself then, what's next in the immediate future, and where is the focus at the moment?
So I'm planning on doing the relay at the World Cup in the London Stadium this weekend, which is sort of the first World Cup competition, so I'm really excited to be involved in that. And then once that's finished, it's sort of a few more races to try and sort of get a decent time down before the team selected for the European Championships, because although I've got the qualifying time, a few other athletes have as well, so it's just trying to sort of show the selectors that I can still run some decent times and I'm worthy of the individual sort of selection.
Mm-hmm. Also something I'm quite interested in is, I suppose relatively recently you've started inspirational talking as well. Yeah. Why was it that you wanted to go down that path?
Well, I did sort of work with a few companies when I was younger, and I really enjoyed doing it. I love sort of going into, I mainly go into schools, but I've sort of worked with a few companies as well. But I just thoroughly enjoy chatting to the kids, and I just sort of look back on my sort of career and my childhood and think that there's literally nothing special about me, and it's sort of, if I can achieve certain things in my career on this sort of athletics track, then there's absolutely no way why other sort of current school kids can't do the same. And I just love going into the schools and chatting to them and sort of making them sort of believe that they can achieve whatever they want to as well, whether it's sport related or not, and sort of how to overcome struggles, because I've had my fair share of struggles in the past. So I just like to go in there and show them that it is possible, and it does happen to sort of normal people, if you like. Mm-hmm. And sort of, yeah, I really enjoy chatting to the kids, really.
Yeah. When you say your struggles, is that things you experienced when you were younger and when you were growing up?
Yeah, I think sort of that, ranging between sort of balancing schoolwork and social lives and training to overcoming injuries or setbacks and people sort of thinking that you're not going to be good enough and all that sort of stuff. That it's, there are so many sort of different setbacks that people, athletes will have, that most people have like similar ones with injuries and things like that. But it's just a case of showing them that it's sort of inevitable that that's going to happen, and these are the ways that I would suggest dealing with them and preventing them and all that sort of stuff.
And we've obviously had a few guests on in the past who've gone down the inspirational, motivational talking side of things, and particularly going into schools and talking to children. And I always ask if, when you were growing up and when you were that age, are the messages you're sending to these kids, are they something that you think you needed to hear when you were that age as well? And is that part of why you do it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when I was at school, we didn't really have people to come in. We had various people that would come in and talk about their careers and things like that, but we didn't really have sports people. And for me, sort of being so keen on sport, I would have absolutely loved to have heard about somebody's journey and how they got to where they are. And I think it would have really inspired me to sort of see that other people will not be sort of the best from age 15 all the way to 35 kind of thing, and that certainly would have really helped me, and that's nice to be able to go in and do that for the kids sort of these days.
Yeah, and when you look at, from say a young girl's perspective, and if you look at campaigns like This Girl Can and things like that, is that another positive message you're looking to reinforce by just going in and talking to some people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, with girls, it can be sort of the teenage, the late teens years is the biggest dropout rate of girls playing sport for various different reasons. And although that was probably the time when I was dropping out of tennis, I was still doing sport and I was just doing a different sport. So I think it's really important to try and sort of keep girls excited about sport. So I do like to chat to the girls too, but the boys as well, it's sort of great for everyone really, and I like to sort of chat to, although I might have more that the girls can get advice from me, but it's just nice to be able to chat to them all really and talk about my journey and how it can help them, whether it's in a similar sort of sporting journey or acting or music or academics or anything like that.
Yeah. Is there a key factor in your mind that helps keep kids in sport at that teenage part of their life?
I think it has to be the enjoyment factor. If sport becomes dull and it becomes a chore, then people just generally aren't going to do it. And one thing that I sort of always say and always sort of suggest with schools and stuff is you should never make sport a punishment. And I think it's so often sort of used if kids are misbehaving in class or things like PE lessons or games lessons, and their punishments to just do laps of a field. Mm-hmm. And that's never going to get kids excited to do cross country or excited to get into sort of distance running or sport in general, because they've only ever seen it as when it's been a punishment. So I think sort of keeping sport fun and keeping kids excited and sort of keen and wanting to do it is so important, and they're much more likely to stick at it if they're enjoying it and having fun.
Absolutely, that's a message I can get behind, and I think a lot of other people can get behind as well. With that, we better wrap up this interview on the podcast. And thank you so much, Emily, for taking some time out ahead of this weekend as well to chat to us on the podcast, telling us about your career and how you're getting on this year. And also, I think those are some very important messages that you put out there at the end about enjoyment in sport, because it's something that we believe passionately in as well. So thank you so much.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much to Emily for taking some time out to chat with us and speak to us on the podcast. Hope everyone enjoyed it as ever with our feature interviews. In terms of final messages and final notices today, as ever, we point people to the direction of our social media pages, because that's where you can find out stuff, like when we accidentally wipe half an episode. We are on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and all of our handles are SportSpielPod, so come along and find us. And you can also email us and get in touch, have a little chat with us. Our email address is sportspielpod@gmail.com. Another message that I'll put across again from last week is that we're on Audioboom now, as hosts, as opposed to SoundCloud, although the SoundCloud page is still going. So that means we're in more places than ever before. We're on Apple Podcasts / iTunes, whatever you want to call it. Spotify, we're on that now.
That. I said while yawning.
We're on CastBox, a whole bunch of things. So wherever you get your podcast, you will probably find us there. The next thing, in terms of scheduling, and when we're doing a next episode, You have a World Cup coming up.
Yeah, soz. It'll probably be August the 12th, 13th. That weekend we'll be back. Well, 11th, 12th. We have a small matter of a Hockey World Cup being hosted in London. Get down and watch it. Even if you don't get tickets, come along to Fan Central or Spectator Village, all in Stratford. It's going to be epic. Hockey, beer, laughters, gold medals, hopefully. It's going to be an epic tournament, so just come down and watch, please.
You had me at beer. And you gave me my tickets today as well, because I will be going down on the 27th of July to watch two barnstorming games.
Korea versus Italy and China versus the Netherlands.
Yep.
Not the greatest fixtures, I apologise.
But if there's beer, it's fine.
You're in the party stand as well.
I'm in the party stand. So if people want to join the club and get tickets, where can they get tickets?
I can't remember the exact link, but if you look on the England Hockey website or the FIH World Cup website, they're both on there. You can still, I think we've just released a few more England tickets as well. So make sure you snap those up, because England are looking in fine form heading into this tournament, he says, with his fingers crossed.
Exactly. So if you have a Russia 2018 hangover and you want some sporting action,
World Cup fever.
There is more World Cup fever to come, and it's in our country.
And we've got two of our previous guests in Giselle Ansley and Catherine Lane representing their country.
Exactly. So we have a vested interest, as well as you, obviously, working for England Hockey. But I think that's it from me. That's it from you.
Bye.
It's bye-bye until we return in however many weeks that is. It's 12th of August. Hope everyone enjoys what's left of the summer. Here's hoping the heat wave continues. And have fun until we next return, everyone. Bye-bye.